We'll start with 20-9591, Vasquez Castillo versus Garland. Ms. Villalpando, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brenda Villalpando, and I'm here representing Mr. Eric Vasquez Castillo, the petitioner in this case. Mr. Vasquez Castillo had been in the United States for 24 years since he was 3 years old before he was removed to Mexico in July of 2020. Mr. Vasquez Castillo has a U.S. citizen wife, a U.S. citizen newborn daughter, lawful permanent resident parents, and a U.S. citizen sister, among many extended family members as well. Based on those relationships, he was eligible to apply for adjustment of status under the former 245I and for a 212H waiver for his criminal convictions. The immigration judge in this case denied that 212H waiver, and the Board of Immigration affirmed that denial. Now, Your Honors, this is a case about the misapplication of a legal standard in Mr. Vasquez Castillo's case.
One question. He is not in this country now. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. He was removed in July of 2020 when the BIA dismissed his appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And as I was stating, this case is about the misapplication of a legal standard and the denial of due process, two issues that this court has jurisdiction to review under 8 U.S.C. 1252A2D. He's asking this court to reverse the board's decision under three main reasons. First, it is our position that the board incorrectly found that the heightened standard set forth in 8 CFR 1212.7D applies in his waiver application. And even assuming that 1212.7D applies, it is our position that the board incorrectly applied that standard because it failed to consider whether the regulations permit other factors besides the hardship to be considered by the board. And third, we are arguing that the board made a mistake in concluding that petitioner was not denied procedural due process during his removal proceedings. In addressing my first point, it is our position that my client's conviction for robbery is not violent or dangerous, and which the IJ and the Board of Immigration Appeals found. We believe this to be a legal error, and it incorrectly applied the Hines standard to my client's waiver application.
So let me ask you about that. So do you agree that if the IJ considered the facts underlying your client's conviction, not just the conviction itself, but if they considered the facts of the conviction and determined that those facts did amount to like dangerous and, you know, dangerous type behavior, that the decision would have been discretionary and non-reviewable?
I do agree, Your Honor. I do agree with that. But in this case, the immigration judge and the board gave, you know, heavy weight to the elements of the offense, to the elements of robbery. And in this case, even though the judge and my opposing counsel does cite to this, is that the judge and the BIA both cited to the police report saying that, you know, that there was a threat to use a gun to be able to take a bike, but that's it. The analysis stopped there. There was no meaningful analysis of why this particular offense, these underlying facts, amounted and rose to the level of being violent and dangerous.
Okay. When did you put on evidence yourself, present any evidence to the IJ that the crime was not as dangerous as it appeared from the nature of the conviction itself?
We did, Your Honor. We submitted the police report, which included the facts and included the testimony of the victim. And that police report corroborated my client's testimony. And the judge found my client to be credible. There was no reason to find him not credible. And my client did testify that no one was hurt, that there was no gun, even though there was a threatened use of a gun, there was no gun during the incident. There was no physical contact. There's no, you know, this offense was committed with a co-offender, and it was a co-offender who made the threat that he had the gun and took the bike. My client was there. He admitted to that and he testified to that. All of that, there's not even evidence that my client spoke to the victim.
Okay, so I want to assume for purposes of our argument that you that the IJ listened to everything your client said and believed him.
Yes.
Could the IJ then, based on that evidence, say, you know what, I've listened to everything you said, I believe you, but I still think what you did was an extremely dangerous act, and so I'm going to apply this heightened standard and find that you're not eligible to stay and have you removed?
You know, the IJ, you know, could have made that finding, Your Honor, but I do believe that he should have explained it in his decision of how that underlying crime, how that underlying offense rose to that level. That wasn't done here. And the BIA pretty much just agreed with the immigration judge's decision and cited to that decision. There was no meaningful analysis of why my client's crime rose to that level, where we see another board president in Matter of Gene. You know, we have a respondent that beat and shook a 19-month-old baby to death. We have more recently Matter of CASD, where we have a respondent who served 9 years in prison for committing a home invasion robbery, bounding the victim, pushing him down the stairs, and causing him severe injuries. So 9 years in prison. Those were clearly dangerous offenses, and both the immigration judges and the BIA did a meaningful analysis of how those offenses rose to the level of being violent and dangerous. And we don't have that here.
Let me ask you on that point. Your analysis seems to be what actually happened. And the reason perhaps there was not actual violence is because the victim simply submitted. And had the victim not submitted, maybe the victim would have been beaten up. Or maybe there really was a gun. Who knows? So why are you looking at it just in terms of what actually happened versus the crime itself and the risk of danger that crime per se presents?
Yes, Your Honor, because under board precedent, under board law, that's what we have to look at. It's a fact-based approach. It's not a categorical approach. It's not looking at the elements of the offense. In this case,
here's the fact. The fact is that these two approach the person with the valuable bike and say, give us the bike or else. And the victim looks them over and gives them the bike. That's a fact, presumably not because he wanted to lose the bike.
That's correct, Your Honor. But also the fact is that there was no weapon present. Matter of Gene calls for that fact-based analysis for that particular reason. It looks as to what happened. And so in this case, in these cases where they have decided that offenses are violent and dangerous, is because there's that the facts support that finding. There was either injury, there was a weapon. Now, I'm not saying that all robbery offenses are not going to be, they're not going to rise to that level. I'm not arguing that. But I am arguing that in this particular case, it just did not rise to that level.
Let me ask whether we need to address the issue you're raising. Because even if, well, let's put it this way, the immigration judge had an alternative ground for denying the waiver of inadmissibility, saying that even if he was eligible, because there were, say, he even found that there were exceptional or extremely unusual hardships involved, that would lead to his eligibility, even if he committed a serious crime, that there is still a step in which the immigration judge can exercise discretion, even if he's eligible. And the immigration judge clearly stated that this is an alternative ground, that even if he is eligible, even if he had establish the hardship necessary for the waiver, that the IJ would exercise his discretion or her discretion. I don't remember the gender of the immigration judge. The IJ would exercise discretion, say, no, I'm not going to grant the waiver in this case. And there are two problems there. One, you didn't challenge that alternative ground. And second, even if you did, given that it's a purely discretionary decision, I don't think we have any authority to review that. We're stuck with it. So respond to that. I think that's an argument made by the government in response.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I respectfully disagree. The fact that the immigration judge imposed the heightened standard is at the core of the argument. In relevant part, Section 8 CFR 1220.7 states that in general, IJ will not favorably exercise discretion. So that imposes a heightened standard of discretion as well, which I did challenge. And that's, I'm not asking the court to reweigh the discretionary factors in this case. I'm not asking, for the court to arrive to a different conclusion that, just because we didn't get the relief that we were seeking for, but I am asking the court to find that the heightened standard was determinative of the discretion because it was a heightened standard of discretion. 1220.7d states that depending on the gravity of the alien's underlying criminal offense, a showing of extraordinary circumstances might still be insufficient to warrant discretion. Those are not normal discretionary factors. It's a very heightened discretionary standard that my client's application was applied.
Did the immigration judge say that even if I don't apply the heightened standard, I would still not exercise discretion to grant relief?
He did not, Your Honor. He, in fact, did not apply any discretionary factor set forth by board president. He cited to the USCIS practice manual, which, I believe it was an error, but he did not. He did not set, an alternative finding for ordinary discretionary factors. He applied the heightened standard and went with that. So, of course, applying the heightened standard of hardship, applying the heightened standard of discretion, it led to the denial of the waiver because he did impose a higher standard. And if there's no additional questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You don't want to talk about the due process issue? If you're going to talk about it now, you're not going to be allowed to bring it up on rebuttal. You want to put that on the briefs? You can submit it on the briefs if you want.
To briefly mention due process, now that the court invites me to address it, I do think in this case, there was a procedural due process violation. At the court of procedural due process, a person has that right to know the opportunity to be heard. And this court has held that. This court has held that, a person doesn't have liberty interest in due process,
that's not the issue. He clearly has a right to be heard. Here, the judge said, I want your briefing by this date, and it wasn't provided. So the opportunity was provided, but just not exercised. He didn't take
Right, Your Honor. And the record shows that the instructions of the immigration judge were that the closing arguments were to be submitted at the next scheduled hearing. Those were the instructions that were set forth. That scheduled hearing was scheduled for December 24th, but that, of course, that hearing was rescheduled due to being a holiday. But the instructions were, and that shows on the record on page 599, where the judge clearly states, I want your closing arguments the day of the next scheduled hearing. I will review them. I will take them into consideration, and then I will issue a decision that day. That was the expectation that we had.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Hardy.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Joseph Hardy for the Attorney General. Of course, I've got my little spiel, but I think I'll go directly to only the two things that came up from the opening. Your Honor, if you look at the, as you mentioned, the board and the immigration judge alternatively found that even if you had established the extraordinary circumstances under the regulation, under the statute, which specifically gives the immigration judge and the board discretion to deny the application, even if the some of the threshold questions are met, ultimately as a matter of discretion, petitioner's counsel concedes that she did not challenge that. That goes by the statute. It doesn't just go by the regulation. You've seen that in cancellation of removal. You can ultimately meet all the threshold questions, even adjustment of status. These are some of those where you can meet all the threshold questions. but the agency still can deny it ultimately as a matter of discretion. And so, and they,
her argument, if I understood it correctly, was it's still a matter of discretion, but if there's been the preliminary determination by the IJ or BIA or both that there was a violent or dangerous crime, then the IJ, well, and the board are instructed that their discretion is to be rarely exercised. And that's a higher standard for the exercise. That's a, yes, higher standard for the exercise of discretion based on a finding, which she is challenging, the finding that it was a violent or dangerous crime.
So if you look at the, both the immigration judge's decision and the board's decision, they both cite to matter of Silva Trevino. And if you look at matter of Silva Trevino itself, it says a matter of Silva Trevino was a case in which the agency or the immigration judge initially found that the alien's crime was violent or dangerous. And then the board reversed that. But the board reversed it and sent it back to the agency, specifically noting that that the agency should still consider whether he merits that as an exercise of discretion under the well-established framework for evaluating discretionary determinations. And if you look, as I say, both agencies cite to that decision here. And I'm talking about, I'm sure some of you are aware of Silva Trevino, the decisions that were issued by the the Attorney General. There's that last Silva Trevino decision that was issued by the board once the other Silva Trevino decisions ran their course. But then you'll see, just like the board did in that decision, the immigration judge and the board in this case weighed the various factors in this case. And they're the same factors. If you look, they both mention his illegal entry into the United States, the fact that he had previously received. I'm sorry, Judge Hartz.
I think I've lost you here because I want to focus on, is there a one standard of review for exercising discretion at this second stage?
Yes, there is. It's all for whether the person is under that.
Okay. Let me finish so I'll be clear.
Okay.
My apologies. I didn't quite finish. Is the standard for the exercise of discretion at this final step, is that standard different depending on whether there's a finding that the petitioner committed a violent or dangerous crime? Does the standard for discretion differ in that circumstance?
So, no, it does not, Your Honor. If you look at, this court has the Brew versus Gonzalez decision, right? And Brew versus Gonzalez, that was where the person was only found to be at the lower. The crime wasn't a violent or dangerous crime. There, the agency ultimately just found that the petitioner didn't establish the extreme hardship. If you're in that circumstance where the regulation doesn't apply, has been found to not apply, and this circumstance where the regulation has been found to apply, under matter of Silva Trevino, you're weighing the equities the same. It doesn't matter that the person ultimately has a violent and dangerous crime. I think petitioner is reading too much into that last sentence of the regulation where it says, moreover, depending on the gravity of the alien's underlying criminal offenses, a showing of extraordinary circumstances might still be insufficient to warrant a favorable exercise of discretion under 212H2. And so it's specifically saying under 212H2, that's the statute that gives the immigration judge discretion to deny the waiver, regardless of the person's of the circumstances of the person's criminal ground of inadmissibility.
Are there any BIA decisions or court decisions that construe that language she's referring to, so we'd have some guidance on whether to adopt your view of how to interpret it or Ms. Villalpando's view of how to interpret it? Do you know?
So I don't think there are any that I don't think you're going to find, and I think that's my point. You're not going to find any that are going to look at this, that language, any differently, whether it's in the Brew or Silva Trevino circumstance, or whether it's in the matter of CASD circumstance, because that doesn't create a higher burden for the alien to establish that he would merit a favorable exercise of discretion. Under 212H2, The alien is going to have to, under the Silva-Trevino fact, or I should say, as Silva-Trevino mentioned, the well-established framework for evaluating discretionary determinations, that's the weighing of the equities. And so the immigration judge here hasn't said that, oh, well, in addition, if you look at the immigration judge's decision and the board, they don't say, in addition, we also find that as an adverse factor, that the crime itself was particularly violent or dangerous. It just points out the fact that he had multiple convictions after he was given administrative closure. So, I mean, that's something that they're going to weigh regardless of the circumstances, as in regardless of whether the crime has been found to be violent or dangerous, or the crime, similar to the Bruce circumstance or Silva-Trevino, has been found not to be the circumstance. So if you see the immigration, if that's the case, if it was the case where the immigration judge was going to apply a heightened standard for weighing the equities under that last sentence, the immigration judge wouldn't have cited to Silva-Trevino, which is a decision in which the board found that the regulation did not apply. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying there? Otherwise, they would have cited to maybe a matter of CASD or something like that. CASD, I don't think they ever really, actually, they did get to the same factors. And if you look at CASD, if I recall correctly, CASD also cites to Silva-Trevino when it does that alternative weighing at the end of the decision. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, it's the same regardless of the person has been found to subject to the reg.
I think you've addressed that issue, so proceed.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, petitioner hasn't addressed that alternative determination. And so that determination is independently dispositive of the entire waiver. And so if you look at some of the arguments that she's making, even as far as the application, or I'm sorry, the agency's conclusion that the statute is violent and dangerous. And so I'm saying violent and dangerous because the agency found that it was both, not that it was one or the other. But the application, that's one. If you look at this court's decision in Galeano Romero last year, that was about the exceptional and extremely unusual hardship determination after, Guerrero Lispria. It's pointing out that when petitioners are trying to point to a particular case and to another agency decision, in this case, petitioner citing to matter of CASD, that's exactly the type of determination that the court found. The value-based determination that the court found in Galeano Romero, that it lacks jurisdiction to review. Petitioner is essentially saying is, well, look at matter of CASD. That was much worse. My guy, he didn't have a gun. He didn't even say anything to the person. No one was injured. He didn't even talk. I believe personally that the person should not have been found to be violent or dangerous. That is the value-based judgment that ultimately is up to the attorney general to decide, not to the court. So the court doesn't have jurisdiction over that equally discretionary determination. The fact that the board in this case cited to these particular cases, I think at one point it does cite to matter of CASD and Silva-Trevino, as I mentioned, but that's just to show, I'm sorry, not matter of Gene. That's just, I mean, that lets you know that, look, the board understood what it was supposed to be looking at. The immigration judge understood what it was supposed to be looking at. And so here, the agency did not, to the extent that we have the legal argument on the table, as far as the categorical approach, the agency did not apply a categorical approach. I mean, if you look at the immigration judge's decision, it specifically cites to the Fifth Circuit's I think it's Gene versus Holder, which then quotes the matter of Gene for the proposition that he was required to look at the nature and circumstances of the crime. And so what petitioner is trying to do here is relitigate the crime and show that, well, look, even the state shouldn't have found me guilty. No, when the immigration judge is citing to or specifically pointing out this court's case law, to say that the crime is a crime of violence, it did exactly what the board did in the matter of CASD decision, that petitioner cites throughout her brief. If you look at CASD, it was about a New Jersey second degree robbery conviction. CASD, the board specifically spelled out the text of the statute, and then it went on to look at the criminal records to find that the circumstances involved were violent and dangerous. Here, the agency looked at the elements to say that, well, you meet these elements, it's a crime of violence under 10th Circuit law. That means that your crime is violent and dangerous. No, it looked at the nature of the crime itself. It wasn't going to relitigate the crime. It just looked at the nature of the New Mexico robbery crime, which this court specifically has found involves the use of force or the threatened use of force. That's the nature of the crime. That's not a categorical comparing of the elements to a generic federal definition. And then the circumstances is, as petitioner conceded, the agency did in this case, was look at the police report, which petitioner herself supplied. The government didn't supply the police report, petitioner did. And then said that the circumstances support that as well, because the petitioner concedes that he and a friend went up to the person, took the person's BMX bike under threatened use of a gun. That's threatened force.
I think we understand your argument on that point. Would you address procedural due process? And one of the arguments made is that the attorney for petitioner missed the deadline for submitting a brief, and opposing counsel has said, no, the deadline wasn't a fixed date. It was the date, whenever was to be, of the next hearing.
That is what the immigration judge, she's correct. The immigration judge says that, okay, we're going to have a hearing on December 16th. The immigration judge told her, we're going to have a hearing on December 24th. You're going to have a written statement that is due that day. Under the immigration court's practice manual, if there is no hearing, then it's been whatever pleading you had due is due by the close of business on that day. The immigration judge never changed the due date for that written statement. And petitioner
to the extent there might be any ambiguity there, was a brief submitted at the rescheduled hearing?
There was no reschedule. It was initially rescheduled, I believe, to January 8th. And then the immigration judge ended up, I think, canceling that hearing. I don't know if he canceled it and set another date, but he eventually issued, and I think we're talking about a male judge, so I apologize to Judge Palomino if I'm saying he, and it should be she, but he eventually issued a decision on January 15th. So petitioner, for one, hasn't explained from a prejudice standpoint, one, why she didn't file the application by December 24th. She's saying to you that it was her understanding that she had to file it at a hearing on December 24th, but she didn't explain that before the agency that, well, look, I didn't file it on December 24th because of XYZ reason. She doesn't explain why she didn't seek an extension of that time. She doesn't explain why within the next 3 weeks, recall that it initially was due December 24th and the immigration judge decided on January 15th, why at no point before then she didn't file it with the immigration judge. But even then, as the board mentioned, the board reviews discretion and judgment de novo. So to the extent that petitioner was going to
said there's some sort of rule of procedure that says if the hearing is not held, then the briefing is the documents are due by the date of that hearing. Is that in the CFR or is that some manual that we don't have in the record?
It's not in the record, but it's Immigration Court Practice Manual Chapter 3.1B. And I believe I do cite that in our answering brief.
Okay. Judge Hartz, could counsel give us that cite in like a 28J letter? Would that be appropriate?
Sure.
I certainly can. I'll do that right afterwards. And then I can, again, say it's on page 33 of the brief, Judge Carson.
Okay.
Actually, let me make sure my table making is correct. Yeah, page 33 of the brief.
Immigration Court Practice Manual, Chapter 3.1B.
Yes. Okay. Judge Carson, you still want a 28J on that one?
No, that's fine. If it's in the brief, I'll find it.
Yeah. Okay. And okay. So, and as the board, and I see I'm over my time, but I see, as the board mentioned, it reviews questions, legal questions, questions of judgment, and questions of discretion de novo. Petitioner had the opportunity to submit that.
Your time's expired, and I do think we understand your argument.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Counsel.
You had some time remaining, as I recall. Your mic is muted still.
Thank you. Just to briefly address opposing counsel's statements regarding the practice manual and the deadlines, he does cite to 3.1B, which generally provides for specific deadlines for submissions before the immigration judge, unless otherwise specified by the immigration judge. And that part of the practice manual is very important. In this case, if it would have been a call update, which is usually done by these immigration judges, that's a specific deadline that's ruled by the date, and that day is at the end of business day. Those documents have to be submitted. That it's normal practice. However, in this case, the judge did not set that deadline. He did not say, by this date, you have to submit your closing dates. I've been practicing for 12 years. If he would have said that, I would have understood that to be the case. In this case, he said, the closing arguments will be done at the next scheduled hearing. I will review them that morning, and I will make a decision, which, again, with my experience with this immigration judge, that is common to do. Okay. So it's not
that. Let me ask you about that real fast, but I mean, he told you a specific date that hearing was going to occur on, and that your brief was going to be due that date. You seem to have interpreted that to mean if he moved the hearing, that it would move the briefing date, but that's not what he said.
It wasn't, we didn't address the possibility of the hearing being rescheduled. All the parties knew that the hearing would take place on December 24th, and he did give the specific instructions that the briefs would be due that day. So that was my understanding.
What about the alternative argument by Mr. Hardy that you haven't shown prejudice because the review by the BIA is de novo, so you could make all the arguments you wanted before the BIA? And probably did make those arguments.
I did make those arguments, Your Honor, but I do think prejudice was shown here. You know, these cases are close calls. They involve extensive legal issues, extensive legal facts. It's been my experience where closing arguments, especially in the case where the judge hasn't made a decision regarding certain legal findings or findings of fact or evidence, it has been my experience that these closing arguments do make a difference. They can make the difference between getting a grant or getting a case denied. Obviously, if we're starting an appeal with a denied case, it's a harder case for us. You know, we do have to overcome. The judges are given deference at the board level. And so if I would have been given the opportunity to submit those closings, my client would have had an opportunity to address all of the issues, which were the same reasons why the IJ ended up denying the case. So I do think that he was prejudiced, and it did create, you know, it did set the tone for the case at the board level. There's no doubt. And if there's no further questions,
your time's expired.
Yes. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted and counsel are excused.